The AWARE Project's aim is to balance the public conversation about psychedelics, spread accurate information, and give a new face to psychedelia. We feel that this change will occur through connection and a relationship, one individual at a time. We are calling on everyone whose lives have been improved through the mindful use of psychedelics to educate themselves, become ambassadors for the psychedelic experience. Show those around you that people who use psychedelics mindfully cross all social, racial, economic, and political boundaries. All right, so I'm really excited to introduce Kathleen Wirt. I'm going to read your little bio.
Don't, because it's part of my talk.
Okay.
That's it. Yeah. Then I have to change what I say.
But I'm just thrilled to have you.
I'm so happy to be
invited.
You're
a perfect, perfect first speaker for our series. So with that,
right now, I swear, I see at least half a dozen people here who used to come to my house, and it makes me like feel like I want to cry. I miss it so much. I'm going to sit down so they don't move it around. and everything that Ashley's saying about what she's hoping to achieve with this meeting, I'm just sitting here thinking we said exactly the same thing 17 years ago. Except it was very scary and very illegal, and we didn't have any lists. The way the whole thing began, I was looking for a place to live. I just left my husband, and I found a house in Venice with a friend of mine who was the secretary for Dr. Oscar Janiger. And the people in the Albert Hoffman Foundation were concerned. They were all pretty much in their 80s, and they were very concerned that their research would be marginalized and that their lives would be not understood, and that they had just suffered like enormous beatdowns through the war against drugs and zero tolerance, and really people had ripped them off. They trusted people who stole things from them, and they were just pretty much at a low point, and looking for somewhere to put their archive of study together, to put it all together somewhere safe where we could start to digitize it and archive it. And we moved in, Lisa and I moved into this house at 2463 Penmar, and the Albert Hoffman Foundation paid a third of our rent and pretty much had the dining room, which was a library. And what really kicked this off, we had finally, everyone was so excited, the Sandoz Corporation had agreed to let go of their documents about the research with LSD. And this was something that at the time, we had like a list of the board of directors, and nobody really wanted to be associated with it. People were very much on the down low. People's research had been discredited. Their lives had been, like I said, discredited. People had their practices taken away from them. They were on FBI watch lists. And so this was very, very, very underground in the beginning. And they started having the board meetings at the house. So they brought in all these books, all these volumes, and some paintings, which I will tell you about in a minute. These gentlemen sat around, and I remember the first board of directors meeting they had at the house. I listened in for a little bit, and the thing went on for maybe 7 hours. And I'm thinking, well, they're all retired, and they don't have anywhere else to go. And they were discussing whether they needed to get some funds happening. And they were discussing, if we had people contribute, say, $20 a month or $25 a year for a membership, would it be a membership? Would they be a member of the foundation or a friend of the foundation? And this created a three-hour discussion over using which word. And I just remember sitting there thinking, oh my God, these guys have done so much I was thinking we need to get some new people on board here. Because this is just, I don't have time for this. Because the discussion was that if we called them members of the foundation, then somehow there was an expectation that they would get something back. Anyway, is that the door open?
No, it's my motorcycle outside.
Oh, okay. Anyway, I started out going to raves with John Beresford, who was a 75-year-old psychiatrist from Canada who headed up the Committee Against Unjust Sentencing. And we would go to these parties, and we had a big poster of the LSD molecule behind us, and we would sign up kids to digitize the documents in the archive. And what was happening is they were saying, oh my God, you know Dr. Janiger? You know, I would just love to meet him. And I was thinking, Oz would love to meet you too. Like, these people would love to know that they're still known and remembered by people and that people still care about what they did. So I started hosting these events as a cross-generational forum to bring people together to just share the wisdom from the elders before they were gone, and to bring together the communities and the tribes. One of my original hopes, and something that sort of happened but never really did, was I knew there was a great divide between these gentlemen and Timothy Leary, because Timothy Leary had popularized LSD use, and they felt like he had been irresponsible about it, and they had a little bit of anger there in just what had happened to them afterwards. And being here in Los Angeles, you know, we had the whole star power was behind Leary. You know, Perry Farrell was going over to his house all the time. I went there one night for an event for the Biosphere, and it was just, you know, it's very star-studded. Winona Ryder, and we didn't have any of those people at all. We were like the scientists and the people who had like done the serious work on the thing. So I say that because we didn't have an email list at first, but we really very much tried to avoid attracting the kind of people who were just like going to come in and talk about their trips and like, party, I'm so fucked up, you know, and try to score drugs or whatever. This isn't what it was about at all. It was about discussing serious research. In fact, I made a list. Basically, it broke down into categories. We had, we talked about entheogens and science. We talked about politics and law. We had and we also had events about culture, or meetings about culture and art, and everything pretty much fell into these categories. When they brought the paintings in, and has anybody seen the 30, actually there were more of them than that, but the paintings that were in Life magazine in 1959, there was a cover story. And they had noticed that, and we had all this research, you know, all the documents of all the research ever done on LSD. So you could just go through my dining room and pick out a book and look at it. They had noticed at one point, and this is maybe in the 1950s somewhere, that, well, 59, that the people who had taken LSD were speaking of it in very visual terms. And so they'd been in clinical settings up until this point. And they said they had a picture, or they had a Kachina doll, and they had people, famous painters, people who were actually artists, paint this doll first when they were not under the influence, and then after they had ingested LSD. And I had 35 of these paintings in my house, and the first ones, the Kachina doll was just blue and green, and he had a red and orange belt. He just had a little splash of red and orange on him right here. And most of the paintings were very realistic, the first ones. Then the ones afterwards were, I mean, just such amazing art. You had like a Mayan Kachina doll. You had alien Kachina dolls. You had, there was a particular group of them, maybe five of them, that were orange. And at the time, I didn't care much for orange. And one of them, I had them all on this side wall over here. I didn't have to look at them all together. And one of them in particular just looked like someone had thrown up all over the canvas. It was just like, and it was about this big. And I was just like, so at some point I had moved them to another wall, and I remember coming out of my bedroom one morning, like all the way to the other end of the house, and you had a clear shot to the other end of the living room, and probably as far as from here to the back wall over there in the dining room, over there in that area. And it was a Kachina doll on fire. And it became my favorite painting. I was just like, oh, you had to be that far away from it to see it. You know, it was amazing art, you guys. Anyway, I was going to address how illegal this was in the day, and I look out here and I see some people that are kind of in my age range, or maybe a little younger, but I was expecting to maybe have to explain about zero tolerance and how dangerous this was. The first gathering that we had, Alexander Shulgin and his wife came down and kicked it off for us. And we had, I remember her coming up to me, and she pulled me aside and she said, you know, we're on an FBI watch list and you're going to be on one too. And I was like, yeah, right. So paranoid. But the next 2 months, every single time I saw a police car, I was pulled over and searched.
Wow.
every single time, six times. If they were in front of me, behind me, other cars, middle of the afternoon, no matter what I was doing, I got pulled over and searched. And so I kind of became a believer in that. And of course, I had nothing on me. There was also, at the time, I was in Venice, I had read in the LA Weekly that they had traps on the telephones so that if you were discussing things or that certain words would come up in conversation, and we weren't using any kind, because we weren't selling anything or, you know, we had no LSD lab in our house, then we weren't really that careful at first about what we were saying. And so I imagine that we might have been targeted, you know, for people checking this whole thing out. We had, well, actually that first meeting with the Shulgins, I remember Jack Herrera was there, and this is one of several times where I, just stumbling into it as a young person, had no idea. These, you know, men had and women had known each other forever, and they didn't all like each other. And here I am just inviting them all over, and then they'd get there and go, oh, so-and-so's here. So Shulgin and Herrera disagreed on what substance would change the world, which you might imagine. I remember that the Shulgins would not let anyone smoke pot in the house. They were like, this, you know, you cannot consume anything at all. So Jack just stood out on my sidewalk and puffed joint after joint after joint right in front of the house, which I didn't find out about it until later, but that was extremely illegal and scary at the time. But Venice being Venice, at the time, you know, we had prostitutes on the corner. It was like nobody really gave a shit. There were meetings where we had fire dancers out in the street and just blocked the street off. And people, nobody ever said anything about it. As the meetings went on, we had we determined not to have any sort of list. And I'm really sorry about that nowadays. I've got very few pictures. I've got, at one point, a few years ago, we had some people together and we all sat down and we tried to write down every meeting that we could remember and every speaker that we could remember, because we didn't take pictures. And there were a few times when we filmed or recorded the meetings, and you might see some of those on Lorenzo Haggerty's site, Matrix Masters. He did record a few, but it was never the crowd or anything. It was just of the speaker, and we were very careful not to get anybody on camera. There was definitely a fear of that. So the political meetings that we had were some of my favorite, because I'm a rabble rouser and very radical, and I wound up having an organization called Rave the Vote out of this, where we would go to festivals and sign up people on ecstasy to vote. hundreds of them, you guys, hundreds of them. And I just remember at one point, the Rockefeller laws, they'd had the big demonstrations in New York, and you could, you know, the black DJs were just like, fuck the police, but the white DJs wouldn't take a stand on anything. And nobody seemed to care. And again, when I talk to kids about this, a pre-Obama world, it's hard to imagine people being so apolitical. But I would say, I would blow up newspaper headlines and put them on a table along with my voter registration forms in our big, you know, Rave the Vote thing. And I would say, look at this, Justice Kennedy says that we should all be seized and searched all the time, that would be more constitutional than just selecting people, that everyone should be subjected to that constantly. Would you like that? Would that affect your life at all? And they go, oh, yeah, and we, you know, well, here, vote. So I think they were probably all Democrats. yeah, this was the year, talking about bicycle rides, where the bicycle riders thought that they were getting a police escort, and the police were, they were moving them through intersections, and they're like, oh, this is really nice. And at the end of the thing, they circled them, took all of their bicycles, sent them to jail, and like strip searched the women five times in 2 days. And like seriously horrible, horrible stuff. And of course, they were sued and they paid, but you know, they, you know who paid? We did, the people who pay our taxes here. We pay for that whenever people sue the police. The police don't pay. You and I do. We had only twice in the 8 years we had the events that we had people that we thought had come in under false pretenses. And one of them was pretty early on. And I remember, Will, you were talking about, you were talking to about the court system. He was saying he was an attorney, but he didn't know anything about the court system or about, where was it, San Diego he was from? You remember? Okay.
But I was a follower of Jack Herer.
Oh, right, right. Yeah, we did. We as the meetings wore on and the years wore on, we got a little less. My bedroom was like the stoner room, and then it started to move out into the living room, and then nobody cared or anything. But the one thing that nobody ever did was try to buy, sell, or ingest any kind of hallucinogen at my meetings. Everyone pretty much had their own sources, and that wasn't what the purpose of the thing. So I would think that if anybody did come in thinking that they were going to, you know, discover something or, you know, bust somebody, there was absolutely no way to do that. This particular guy asked a lot of questions, wanted to know who's who and what we were up to, and I think he must have been very disappointed. And we were just on again. And then the other time, it was really funny, I used to, when I told people about this, I would just say, well, it's the Albert Hofmann Foundation, and which sounds very scientific and, you know, scholarly if you don't know who Albert Hofmann is. And I found that that was a very good screening mechanism. You know, I'd just say this flatly, and if anybody knew who Albert Hofmann was, then they were totally cool with what they meant was. So we had a guy that showed up one night and in one of our raucous free-for-all discussions or whatever, and I remember him going, wait a minute, he goes, everybody knows that ecstasy's bad for you. He goes, are you talking about, it's okay to take it? And everyone in the room just sort of turned around and like, and it was just silence. And then somebody goes, how did you get here? Who invited you? You know, because every once in a while, someone would come that thought, ooh, this is a really neat gathering. Because we did have meetings that sometimes would be about art or culture. We had one of our members worked at the tar pits, the La Brea tar pits, and took pictures of really beautiful psychedelic pictures of the sun play on the oil and the water, and backlit those. And you know, we had him come in and show us, you know, a whole evening of his artwork. And you might not have realized that everyone in the room, you know, was an experienced traveler, shall we say, from meetings like that. So you could see that if someone had come maybe on the wrong night. But we did not publicize this to anyone. People found out about it, and sometimes it took a while for people to find out about it. I remember when Gary Fisher, who is now out of the research closet and is being recognized for what he did, he gave LSD to autistic children in the 60s and had a phenomenal success rate. Like, I remember him saying there was one little girl who did nothing but scream, and that she had at one point, they called it the God room where they would go in and do this, but she took him one day and she goes, you have to understand, Dr. Fisher, I still have a very long ways to go. And it's like, just actually said this. But after the hysteria over LSD, you know, sort of launched, they, from what he had said at the meeting, they destroyed his research. I mean, people's lives were ruined over this. Much the same sort of thing was happening with MDMA, and this was the reason for why the whole meeting was so timely, is because, as I used to tell people when I was explaining this, that in every culture, not every culture, many tribal cultures throughout history, when you're like 15, you go out and you ingest something and you find your animal spirit or whatever. And that's illegal in this country to do that. But it doesn't stop the human need for the children to separate themselves from their parents or to find their own, you know, entities and discover themselves. So that was definitely one of the major pushes of many of our topics. We had Raphael Eisner came in. And I had so many young ravers tell me that they wished their friends had been there, or their boyfriends, or whatever, where he explained how MDMA works, and that you couldn't take more and get off more. And I'm assuming that probably most people in this room are aware now that, you know, if you take 5-HTP, like, he basically said you could do it 12 to 20 times a year with absolutely no ill effects at all, as long as you gave your serotonin time to build back up. And that, I see now that there's a, you know, they call it Molly nowadays, but there's definitely an interest and a return to that, because toward the end of this era, everything was so adulterated that, you know, I have to say that one of the reasons, there were several reasons why we stopped doing this. One of them was that everybody died, like all of our scientists and the elders were gone. But that the scene had been, well, the researcher, is it Ricoh, how you pronounce his name? The one who falsified his research.
Oh, I don't remember what his name is.
Ricoh. I didn't know if you pronounced the T or not. He got, there's this level of hysteria up with the Bush administration where he said that there was like a, what was it, a 40% mortality rate, something crazy.
Or you got, I think it was like Parkinson's.
But they were talking about a mortality rate, and it took several years for someone to go, wait a minute, if all these kids are doing this every weekend, we don't have all these people dropping dead, and this isn't happening. But it served to do a couple of things. Number one, you could not play electronic music in public without getting arrested. You couldn't gather. They passed laws in Europe against gathering or playing electronic music. I talked to some people at your house last night
Anders,
who said, that you could... I know that we would go out to, you know, to desert parties, and we'd keep an eye out, and we'd put on like country music if we saw the Rangers coming. and did that make them think we were all doing speed? I don't know, you know, but I it would make me very angry to be you know, pigeonholed into this. And then of course you go, well, they are right, we are doing this, you know, but definitely should not have been demonized the way that it was. And the word rave became a bad word, and you just couldn't use it anymore. In fact, when rave the vote was folded into rock the vote, it was at this point where you couldn't use the word rave anymore. And I was really pushing for them to call it roll the vote. Because I thought that would be pretty cool. I'm going to see about some of the discussions we had. One of the political, does anybody know Francis Della Vecchia in here?
Yes.
Yeah.
Francis, when Francis was running for mayor, he came in and read one, read the first chapter of his book. And this is a whole category, ego. I sometimes did not realize what I was stumbling into when I would invite people who maybe didn't get along with each other. And I would just kind of laugh about it, because I think, well, what we're told is the whole lesson here about this process is that it's about a loss of ego, and we're supposed to lose our ego in the process. So what does it mean when our elders have like this ego showdown in front of us? It was kind of amusing, actually. And there were only a few times where I'd have to just stand up and stop it, you know? And you know, when I was like 30 years old, 35, well, maybe 37. But I would, you know, to actually get up and tell someone with a PhD in his 80s to stop talking was a difficult thing to do, but every once in a while I'd have to do it. And I just remember one of my favorite ones, we had Art Kunkinen from the LA Free Press, and Art had quite famously published the addresses of all the drug officers in the LAPD or in California. They didn't have a DEA back then, did they?
Back in the 60s, though.
Yeah, back in the 60s. But this is one of his big claims to fame. He'd been hung out with Timothy Leary. Art had a great pedigree, you know, and it was definitely somebody we wanted to talk to. Well, Myron Stolaroff was also a dear friend who was on the board of directors of the Albert Hoffman Foundation, and apparently they had a rivalry that I was unaware of. And when Art found out that Myron had spoken at my gathering, Art had to talk too. So he came down, we scheduled him for a talk, and I just remember there being a rather increasingly pointed discussion about whether or not Americans could truly practice Buddhism. And it just got really ugly, and I finally just had to go, stop, we're not gonna talk about this anymore. Iris Lord was one of these people, and Iris is still around, but she's had a stroke and she's in New York. And Iris was in her 70s, and I remember her telling me, she had a stage show that she did called, there weren't very many women at these things, by the way. It was largely male, and especially the older women who were there, the women who were in their 60s and 70s, were just fabulous people. Myron Stolaroff's wife, Jean, told me one time that when she was 15, she and her girlfriends in New York used to steal a car and drive in to New York City to see Frank Sinatra play, which I was just like, that is so punk rock. It's just wonderful women. Anyway, Iris did a stage show called 12 Famous Men, and she had relationships with people like Marlon Brando, Lenny Bruce, like really an amazing life. Some of these relationships when she was 14 years old, which, like, I don't know, I work in the music business and I hear these things and I don't know, but just suddenly, I guess it used to be legal to have sex with 14 year olds. I mean, like, nobody used to care. It's a little disturbing. But she and her sister, her twin sister, very beautiful. She looked at 74, she was a very beautiful woman. Anyway, God bless Iris. She's in New York, and she and her husband call me every now and then, but she's unable to talk on the phone. We had all of, like, a who's who, like, talking about the scientific programs that we had, and the ones that were about drugs. I'd go, we need someone to talk about ketamine, and we'd find a guy, and he'd come in and speak. We need someone to talk about salvia divinorum. Well, there's a guy who grows it up in Malibu, we'll have him in. We had so many talks about ayahuasca and ibogaine. I've never done either one of those substances, but I was in the minority. I would say maybe a third of our attendees had. In fact, one of the things that they said about these gatherings was that if you wanted to be a speaker, you better know your topic pretty well, because there were probably many people in the audience who knew as much or more about your topic than you did. I'm recalling Christmas. We had a Christmas program about the shamanic origins of Christmas. And my roommate at the time was he was taking so long to talk about, like, everyone in the audience was just kind of like, I know, the reindeer, they drank the reindeer piss because they ate the mushrooms, and you know, the Amanita muscaria mushroom is on all these woodcuts, and they do just basically kind of wrested the discussion away from him, and everyone else gave the talk. You know, like, apparently we all knew everything, and we didn't even need anyone to talk about it. We had a girl in who did a documentary about Chernobyl, and I remember that she was very surprised, like at the level of knowledge that we had in this group. In fact, Ed Jaffe said to me one night, I remember this, he just goes, well, once again, Kathleen, all the smartest people in L.A. are at your house on Friday night. because L.A. kind of has a reputation for not being that deep. And I found that later on when we started using an email list, but we never did like a group, and we never published it in any way, I would just kind of lose some people's email addresses if they caused us too much trouble. You know, if people came in just wanting to talk about themselves or hijack the discussion or wanted to give shit to the speaker, because that wasn't what it was about. It was about a good feeling thing and about making our speakers feel welcome. And definitely, you know, whenever we opened the thing up for discussion, I just would always look at the look of delight on our speaker's face when he would hear, like, how intelligent and pointed the questions were. You know, it was like, this was really a great place to talk about your area of interest. Anyway, we had obviously the people from Arrowhead. Rick Doblin was in a couple of times, well, more than a couple of times. I remember he came back from Palenque, and we used to hang a sheet on the back wall for a screen, and he was showing slides from Palenque, and he got up and he just sort of shook, there was a picture of one of the ruins, and he shook the sheet so that it shimmered, and he goes, this is what it looked like to us. anything. Andy Papp, oh my God, Andy. We didn't have too many people. We had a few people who came in who had not tasted the sacrament. I had a roommate who was one of them. She was a fundamental Christian, and I always felt like it was really, really big of her to be so open-minded, that she would help me get ready for the meetings, she'd help me clean up afterwards, and she would be at all of them and listen to everything everybody had to say with a very open mind. Yet she was definitely like as fundamental as it gets about heaven and hell and you know, all of that. She Andy Papp was another one. Andy is now a definite part of the community, he goes to Burning Man every year, but he's a scientist who invented the clone gun, and he was a very kind of crotchety guy. And I remember we never had any pot in the food. That was just not even discussed. It was just understood that that was one of the rules. We were not dosing anyone. We weren't like getting high at the meeting. This was not for that. And somebody, then I used to give a prize for the best homemade dish. And it was usually just some weird thing I found in my house because I had so much crap in the house. I just go, oh, here, we'll give this away. But Andy, they said these were extra leaded brownies. And he asked me several times, he goes, does that mean they have pot in? I'm like, oh, no, Andy, no, it just means it's extra chocolate. And I was so sure that it was. Well, it turned out, nope, I was wrong. And he ate like four of them. And Jesus. And it's probably the only time that I really ever, like, started sweating at that event, because Andy was, I thought at the time he was the kind of person who would sue me, and I remember I sat next to him the rest of the night and held his hand, and he was being kind of crotchety and mean, but I just sat there and held his hand because I didn't want him to sue me. Anyway, I had to call Andy down a couple of times and just say, hey, you were mean to the speaker, or you got to stop that. You got to stop questioning too hard. Definitely a high point. Allen Ginsberg read his poetry in my living room, and many times when these speakers would come, I'd have their book that they wrote, and I would have them sign it, and that was one of only two times someone stole something from my house. Someone stole the book of poetry that Allen Ginsberg signed for me, so I'm really sad about that. Some dickhead has a book that says, thank you, Kathleen, and, right? And that will remind him constantly that he stole it. We had a guy whose dad was a blacklisted writer, wrote a screenplay about when he was under surveillance by the FBI. Amy Pofal Ralston, who served some of the most poignant meetings that we had, were people who had been victims in the war on drugs. And we had a couple of really notable meetings where people had been incarcerated and had a lot to say about the prison industrial complex. And Amy was one of those people. In fact, she's made a movie about marijuana, which some of you guys may have seen, Amy Ralston. It follows the legal history of marijuana. And anyway,
do you know what
you definitely need to have her speak at one of these. She was fabulous. Her ex-husband, her estranged husband, was manufacturing MDMA in Germany. And when they made it illegal in America, the FDA, or the DEA, arrested him when he came back into the country. And they started pressuring her. And they wanted her to wear a wire and go to all of his contacts. And she was like, I'm not with this man. I haven't been with him for years. I don't know any of these people. And I'm not going to do it. And they harassed her for 2 years. She said at one point they like kicked in all her walls, they tore the door off her refrigerator, they threw things around, they told her that they were going to make her sorry that she hadn't cooperated. And the worse things got, the more determined she became to not help them at all. And every time she got a job, they'd call up her employer and tell them that she was under federal drug investigation. Anyway, she's 100% innocent. She got a 19-year sentence. And served 9 years of it before President Clinton pardoned her. And this was so chilling, you guys. I have the legal things that we did to try to help people were, I get goosebumps easy, but I have it right now, thinking about these poor women in jail that basically, if you don't have anyone to turn in, you know, the man that these, one woman, her roommate, I think, was in jail for 25 years for translating a telephone call. If you wanted to get a conspiracy verdict against people, you had to have three people, and the undercover agent could not be one of them. So they would have, just trump up all these charges against the girlfriend, and she would have nobody to turn in. So she'd wind up going to jail for 25 years, and the man would be out, because he'd turn in, you know, somebody, and he would go free. And it just really, really awful. That's one of the things that John Beresford was involved in with the Committee Against Unjust Sentencing, the November Coalition, and the Tallahassee Project, which profiled 100 women in Tallahassee prison and what had happened to their families. All of this, I mean, the good news is all of this is news in the newspaper right now. You know, it started out with really only the libertarians and like some hardcore Republicans would even agree with you on this, that it didn't make sense to be punishing these people. But through some of these talks, we definitely saw how the prison industrial complex profited from these things. And it was so clear that at the end of the Cold War, that there was a need to have a war against somebody, and so America turned to war against its own people. And we were the guerrillas in the trenches, you know?
Do you remember what your movie was called?
It was something like Pot. Like, I remember thinking, like, this, like, everybody's made a movie like this, but I went to the premiere, and it was really well done. And I, you know what? I'll let you know, and I'm in touch with her, and you guys should definitely have her for a speaker here. She's an amazing, amazing speaker. People who were invited had to be vetted. Like, you couldn't just tell anybody, especially in the early days, about the meeting. We actually mailed out the invitations in the early days. We were careful not to say anything on the phone. Laura Huxley was my house. I'm just looking through the list here. You know, Dr. Janiger, Oz, he talked about the LSD studies he did with Cary Grant. We had Cary Grant's handwritten notes about his LSD experiences in my house. And in fact, I've got a really great story about that. Eva Marie Saint had said that when she was doing North by Northwest with him, that she felt very uncomfortable and he wasn't very nice to her and she was really freaked out and she didn't feel like she was doing a good job. And then one Monday he came in completely different. And she said it was after the weekend after he had done LSD. Anyway, he did it over 200 times with Oz and we had all of his notes. Anais Nin, we had Laura Huxley, you know, Aldous Huxley's widow came. Myron, who wrote The Secret Chief. John Lilly was there. John had, this was in his phase where he'd been sitting on Venice Beach in his Speedo in his wheelchair doing ketamine and pretty much kind of, I was upset with him over the dolphin thing and I was obviously very nice, but he was just barely there. But I do have a photo of him at my house. So it was just pretty much all the notables before they were gone. We never had Terrence McKenna. But if you look down the list of the board of directors, we stopped dropping them off the list when they died because we realized we just needed to put a little star next to their name and say deceased because they remained who they were and their name on the project, you know, remained important. And I'm very, very happy that this is going to happen again, it looks like. And more openly and with more support from the rest of the country, you know, where you don't have to discuss. I remember Lorenzo Haggerty had a meeting where I think he was still working for AT&T or something when he did this, but it was like, how do you talk to people about this without getting fired? How do you know who it's safe to talk to? And we actually had a meeting about techniques and you know, different strategies for bringing this up to people that you worked with, or, you know, hey, I saw this thing on TV the other night, you know, and act like you didn't know anything or act like you didn't have an opinion to draw people out to try to educate them, you know. It was a very exciting time. And whenever we didn't have, every once in a while we wouldn't have a speaker or someone would cancel. And I'd just invite in maybe a musical group that I worked with or one of my favorite meetings was Walter King, who just passed away a couple months ago. Walter was a civil rights attorney, and he had been turning up for several years, and I didn't really even know who he was. But we had about six people there that night. It was a very small group, and because we just had it the third Friday night of every month, no matter what. At some point, we stopped. We didn't even need to send out an announcement. People would just come, you know, and it went on. I think we only took off maybe five times in 8 years. Like, seriously, it was always happening. And Walter, I said, well, who are we? Who's here? Let's just everybody go around and tell their story. And Walter got up and he told of how he had been, his family had escaped Nazi Germany when he was 8 years old. and they had gone to Italy, and that he had joined Mussolini's fascist youth brigade, and how he had Mussolini and Hitler had pinned a pin on him on stage, and he said, he goes, "I could have killed them both, but I was only 8 years old." And then he sang two fascist youth songs in Italian in the living room, and told us how, like, after the war, his dad married an Egyptian slave, and he would join the Merchant Marines, and then he's cruising across some body of water in South America, and they're going, "Come join the revolution," and he's like, "I'm going to go to the United States and get rich," and which he never did. But and it was Che Guevara. I mean, the scope of the people. If someone did LSD in 1959, you guys, they pretty much, many of them had also like climbed Mount Everest. Like, I can't tell you what great adventurers these people were, and what special souls. The first meeting that we had, I had three members of the Adventurers Club, which, you know, you have to climb Mount Everest to be in that, and you got to be nominated by someone else. And at one point, I had like all these people in the kitchen, and I'm like, "Everyone who floated naked down the Amazon is talking in the kitchen." And these people would meet each other and they'd go, "Oh yes, you married me in Fiji in 1949. Just fabulous, fabulous. And I hope to create some new memories here. I start out now maybe as one of the elders, which is kind of fucked up and sad.
But awesome too.
Yeah, anyway, somebody's got to, you know, people got to step in and take it from there. Anyway, anybody got any questions?
Sweet. Well, thank you.
Oscar Janiger's take on LSD, just briefly.
Oz did it like into his 80s when he got together with Albert Hoffman as elderly men. I remember seeing a picture of the two of them, and I think they were like in their underwear in some bushes, just sort of like hey, you know. They Oz. I'm very concerned about what happened to the archive. I know that things started to disappear out of it, and there was an unfortunate situation with my roommate that I won't really go into, who was the Oz's secretary, and they had a big falling out, and I wasn't really implicated in it, but they did find a more permanent home for the collection, and it went to Pasadena.
I think Erwin took it over.
Did they? Do they have the paintings? Do they have the paintings?
I don't know about the paintings,
yeah,
but they...
there are the paintings.
Okay, yeah, because I emailed the Albert Hoffman Foundation, being like, let's see if anyone responds, and Earth responded back to me. And
oh,
she
good.
Said they
good
took,
to
they
know.
Took over the
I'm
whole
I'm so glad to hear that. Because, well, obviously the LSD books, I had the 75 volumes from the Sandoz Corporation, those right there, and then the paintings were like part of my, and I had Ron Breton, do you know Ron?
Mm-hmm.
Ron was the president of the Albert Hoffman Foundation, and the final things I found when I moved out of Penmar, I had things in my garage that I gave to them. In fact, you guys, I'm writing about this because we were evicted from this house about 2.5 years ago, and I just started thinking about what had gone on there, and what an amazing salon this was, and that it was, you know, in my mind, you know, I don't want to say it's as important as Millwood, but it certainly maybe, you know, was on the list of great salons in the history of our culture. And I didn't want it to be forgotten. And I'm also very you know, pissed at the evil people who kicked us out of our house. So I have this sort of flower revenge planned where I want to tell people that if they are in Venice, that they should put some flowers on the fence at 2463 Penmar. So if you guys are ever around there, write down the address and just stick some flowers in the fence so that whoever's living there will just go, "What are these fucking hippies doing? Stick flowers on our fence all the time." You know, make a little pilgrimage to where this all happened.
Definitely, and some of Oscar's research or Oz's research was I found actually on the fly at Burning Man photocopies.
Oz had trusted someone to be his assistant, and this is before we got involved. And they had stolen a lot of this stuff, and they were selling it on the internet. So I don't know if that's the case. But I do know that's one of the reasons that they felt kind of beaten down and didn't feel, you know, felt like they've been used by people. Yeah.
As we start off this salon series, what do you think are some of the most important things to learn about and encourage people to?
It's engaging people, you guys. And actually, I didn't mention this. Fraser Clark came to one of our meetings, and he said that he had heard about what we did, and which was very flattering because obviously, like I said, we weren't public. And he said that he came to speak to us because he thought that Southern California youth were going to change the world. And he said it's because we are exporting the entertainment industry and people care about what we wear, what we say, what we do, what we think, and what we believe, and that we can influence people. And definitely that was always part of my my manifesto, was to try to change the world and to affect other people. We had like a discussed a lot about having like a media desk because all these people had PhDs and they could, like, when the newspaper had some inaccuracy in it, they could say, well, you know, actually you can't die from eating psilocybin, you know, or things like this. You know, there was a need for expert voices. So I think definitely to keep in mind about how we engage the rest of the world and how we can affect public policy and laws. It seems to me like that's the way it's going because it's just not financially feasible for them to put everyone in jail in America unless the rest of us work at the jail, you know? Yeah. Yeah, but definitely I think just by being knowledgeable and being able to counteract the hysteria or any misinformation that you might run into, there's a great deal of power in knowledge. And definitely that whatever you learn at these things, you take with you and spread out to more people.
Mm-hmm. How do you think the psychedelic culture has changed since the time when you were hosting these style of events? And what?
Well, you can use the word rave again.
Yeah.
You know, it seems very similar. You know, it's interesting because I'm pulling things I used to wear out of my closets and or my, you know, trunks, and I'm going, oh wow, I can wear this again if I lost some weight. that it seems to me that, you know, how culture and fashion and everything seems to come back around like once every 20 years. A lot of things seem very 1990s to me right now. The only thing that's different is the openness in which we can talk and the ease with which we can gather. You know, that we can, you don't have to print up flyers and put them around anymore or call people on the phone or put a stamp on something. You know, all you have to do is just type it up and hit a button. And I think the opportunities to engage people are enormous. That would be the difference is the internet, you know.
Yeah.
Do you think you're still on the FBI watch list?
You know, you guys are too now.
We're all on Facebook.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think they gave up on me, but yeah, it was pretty scary there for a little while. I remember one guy, one of the policemen, he's like, he actually put me in the back of his car, and I was thinking, I suddenly remembered I had a butt of weed in a glove box, and I'm like, oh, shit. And he came in, and I thought he was going to go, what's this? But instead, he turned around to me, and he goes, are you living out of your car, Kathleen? What? You know, I was an actress. I had shoes and stuff in there. You know, I'm like, no. And then he goes, "You're on methamphetamine, aren't you?" And I'm like, "No, I don't do that." And then he goes, "Well, you're a wreck." And I just burst into tears. And I go, "I'm not a wreck. I'm wearing a dress and I have a makeup and I take my vitamins and I work out." I go, "If you think I'm a wreck, it's because I'm 35 and I'm." Old. And then he like starts touching me. Oh no, you're a very attractive woman, Kathleen. Yeah, it's just yeah. Yeah, you know what? There's a difference. You'd have a camera on that right now, and you wouldn't be calling me. Yeah. Exactly. Yep.
That's the Patriot Act challenge some of the ways you feel congregations used to happen. I remember that Russian ebook cracker came in as like a traveler, and yet they held him without trial for.
We had so many horror stories about stuff like that. I mean, seriously, like I don't think people really know. Like kids today, you don't know. We had to walk to school barefoot. Like seriously, it was really scary. I remember the TIPS program. You know that there was a definite fear that somebody could turn you in for being un-American. And you know when Bush won, it really got worse. You know it was the level of paranoia and fear. And then at some point, you know every once in a while, people would be like, "Well, we're gonna move." Like we had a biofuel bus come through, and everybody's going to Costa Rica. Come join us. People wanted to move to New Zealand. It was like, do we stay and fight? Because I had a definite belief that you can't be like some kind of martyr if nobody knows about you. Like there's no sense of throwing away your life for a cause if you're not going to change anything. And one of my ideas that I really liked a lot and that I think someone still should do is that with the red states and all the ignorance back there. You know, when I go back to Springfield, Missouri, I always make it one of my things that I do to, I upset people, I provoke people, but not in a bad way. I talk to them and I give them facts. I speak authoritatively about things and they can't, like, you know, tell me that I'm wrong. And that we should send people in like spies or something to go in and like open up little coffee shops in small towns across America to engage people in conversation and change their minds.
Absolutely.
You know, instead of just sitting in a tree, which, you know, and you know, like butterfly, whatever, you know, like, or blocking traffic or doing things that obstruct things, why not find ways to really change things? You know, I think that would be very sneaky, like wonderful, you know, guerrilla thing to do is to send people in, like, you know, missionaries for higher consciousness. You know, you'd probably have to be blonde to go do it or something. You'd have to look like the people who live there. And just kind of subversively start to work on them and change their minds. Yeah.
I was wondering if anybody in your group had done any research about other revolutionary things that had happened in history and used those parallels and found things that worked in terms of...
That sounds like it'd be a good talk for you to give.
I don't know about it.
I almost minored in history. I'm a revolutionary for sure. And I have to say that the end of every century, you find certain things, like the ideas of free love and flight and open-mindedness. There's certain things that come back around, like the end of the 1700s, end of the 1800s, end of the 1900s. And you definitely, you know, like whether it's a balloon or the Wright brothers or the space shuttle, and free love seems to be the same every time. but there's definitely... they had French have a word for it, fin de siècle. You know, it's an openness that we have when the century is changing over. And, you know, here we are. I know that I didn't pay off any of my charge cards till after 2012, but just in case. I was like, what the hell? You know? I'm like, I'm not going to worry about this if the world's going to end, and then damn it, it didn't. But no, I think that's very interesting, yeah. And I would say that I know that I had a definite interest in that. I mean, I know a lot about the French Revolution, the American Revolution, and definitely I saw what we were doing as a bit revolutionary. You know?
I mean, have we employed any of those techniques and used them in their working? Like, is there anything that's happened... The causes of us being able to have this meeting in a more open way that had been done through revolutionary activity, or it's just happening because everybody's doing it, or what? I'm just wondering what we're doing to actually forward that.
I'd say that the cost, the thing that I think has changed public opinion the most is just the cost of the drug war. Is who was it that said that when the punishment is worse than the offense? Then you've got to take a look at it. And just the fact that we have more people incarcerated per capita than any country in the world, I'm just nauseated to know that it was a guy from, what is a New Jersey prison at Abu Ghraib, who taught everybody what to do there, that you know, people are so routinely abused. The poor man in Florida that they boiled to death in his shower this year, an 180 degree steam shower. Do you guys know about that?
No.
Yeah, I mean, we've got a long ways to go on crime and punishment here. And that, again, you look here, we are on the west side of California, of Los Angeles. We, no matter what our financial state may be, we are privileged people, and we're in a position to try to change things, you know, without the dangers, the routine dangers that many people face, you know. You know, I mean, the whole police brutality cases and what, you know, the Black Lives Matter thing, I think that ties in very much to this, because especially the way that the laws have been disproportionately, you know, leveled against minorities. It's just really, we think this country's free, but I think we all know that it's not. So glad you guys invited me to come here. We're probably going to upload them to some kind of site or something.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't have
maybe
a slideshow or anything.
Or something.
If you don't know, the people are kind of blown anyway. So, but
yeah, just to close off, I mean, I think that having this kind of historical context to this new Salon series, I think is really important to be able to take a moment of gratitude that things are a lot better now in terms of being able to be more open about these things. And I think that this is a really good time to be able to think about, you know, we do have the freedom of speech here, and I mean, you can talk about your experiences to the people that you love and, like, start sharing your stories. I mean, I wouldn't talk about, like, buying, selling, or making anything, but you can share your stories. So, you know, consider the people in your lives that that are very close to you that don't know this aspect of you, so that we can start changing the public perception. I think one of the biggest the people that tend to get kind of pushed over to the other side of voting for medical marijuana are people who do know someone that uses medical marijuana. So I think in the same way, if you become an ambassador and show that you're, you know, an intelligent, you know, person that's got their stuff together, and you say that you have tried some of these things and it's made a positive impact on your life, it makes people curious, you know. And with the AWARE Project, we're not advocating for, like, full legalization or you know, that everybody should do psychedelics, but we're just trying to make people curious about these things and encourage people to maybe rethink what they think about psychedelics, and to hopefully, you know, start to be able to get more research funded, because at least it's just going to make it more safe, you know, for the people that may do these things, no matter if they're legal or not. And at best, it could be a whole new area of therapy for people that have, you know, really tough, psychological or whatever kind of situations. So I'm really excited to be starting this series out, and please stay tuned. We're going to have our next speaker next month is going to be Vicky Kraft, who is the leader of the Santo Daime, the first legal Santo Daime church in California, and it just became legalized in past June. So the Santo Daime is an ayahuasca church from Peru, so it's pretty exciting that this is the first legal one in California. So she's going to talk about the legal process that she went through to get her church legalized. So please come back, share the event, bring friends, and spread the good word.
List.
Yes, and please be on get on the email list and check out Bicycle Day and awareproject.org. So thank you.